Now, this incremental is by Mr. K.R.A. Hart. It was a lecture on the 28th of July, 1946. So this isn't part of the dictation, which is why I'm reading it at that speed, just to let you know. And it's just a part of it. And it's all about the Chancery Division. So I'll just have another quick slap. It starts at 100, goes up to 290, and then I think back down for a minute. And we have, just to let you know at the beginning, 20 minutes up to 290, and then another, almost another minute. So, oh yes. But I don't mind if you drop out partway through, it's entirely up to you. It's syllabically counted, so if you're ready, like listen with mother, then I'll begin. Okay, ready. The Chancery Division is one of the three divisions of the High Court of Justice. The nominal president is the Lord Chancellor. One of the courts of the division being actually called the Lord Chancellor's Court. Judges of the division were, up to a few years ago, 6 in number, but are now only 5. The business of the Chancery Division is the administration of that portion of English law which has the name equity. Equity is actually defined as that portion of a natural justice of a nature to be judicially enforced, which the courts of common law have omitted to enforce. This is the definition of equity in its technical sense. In its legal sense, it means those rules and principles which came into being out of an extraordinary jurisdiction, which was originally that of the Chancellor and later became that of the Court of Chancery. Originally, the fountainhead of all justice was personified by the king. Equity, from the Latin word equitus, was described as flowing from the conscience of the king, and thus meant what is fair and just. So it was that ultimate appeal to the king against the decision of his courts was the right of every subject of the king. Naturally, subjects availed themselves very extensively of that right, with the result that it became very necessary for the king to find someone who could deal with appeals instead of having to do so himself. This someone was the Chancellor. Up to the date of the Reformation, the Chancellor was invariably a high ecclesiastical dignitary. As such, he looked after not only the spiritual well-being of the population, but also the conscience of his royal master. Hence he came to be described as keeping the king's conscience. As to the judge whose business it was to consider cases which found no remedy in the ordinary law of the land, the Chancellor would hear appeals from the courts of common law. This practice led to the growth of a corpus of law outside the common law. It was alleged to be founded on rules of law which in themselves were better than the rules of common law, and from this it was but a step to claiming to take the place of the common law altogether. The Chancellor, when he started exercising this jurisdiction, did so in the name of the King, in Council. The divergence from this position was slow, but, nonetheless, surely there came into being a Court of Chancery which exercised its jurisdiction in complete independence of the King. When, after the Reformation, a high ecclesiastical dignitary no longer held the office of Chancellor, that office was thenceforth generally held by a lawyer of suitable eminence. The nature of the court, however, and the remedies that it could grant, and the jurisdiction that it exercised, were unchanged. The transition from the ecclesiastical to the early legal atmosphere became completed by the circumstance that the court of the Lord Chancellor had its seat in the old hall of Lincoln's Inn. The courts of common law, not to be outdone in eminence or dignity, were holden at Westminster under the aegis of the Lord Chief Justice. Perhaps not altogether surprisingly, this separation in locality certainly did not make for peace and harmony between the courts. A litigant who went to the common law courts and found himself disgruntled with their award could and did appeal to the Lord Chancellor against that award, a proceeding dignified by the less embittered and more resounding phrase, filing a bill in equity for relief. The importance of the Chancery Court, however, grew not less but greater, and ultimately something took place which was almost in the nature of a pitched battle between two divisions. In the case of Courtney versus Glanville, Lord Chief Justice Coke took the course of declaring illegal a decree in equity and an imprisonment for contempt. In the Earl of Oxford's case, Lord Chancellor Ellesmere granted relief, in answer to a bill in equity, to the Earl after the common law courts had found against him in an action for ejectment. Later, Lord Chief Justice Coke stated roundly that he would not listen to any counsel who took part in presenting bills of equity for relief against judgments which the courts of common law had given. This caused Chancellor Ellesmere to appeal directly to James I. James referred the matter to his legal advisers, who came down on the side of Lord Ellesmere. This view was clear and unequivocal, but for more than 250 years afterwards, common law and equity went very much their separate ways, common law remaining the purview of the courts of Exchequer, Common Pleas and Queen's Bench, equity that of the Court of Chancery. As the word equity itself implies, business of the Court of Chancery was to see that equity was done, a task fulfilled, as often as not by seeing that the reverse of equity, or, in other words, what was unfair, was not done. It would see, as it still does, that fraud was not perpetrated, that the terms of trusts were faithfully and properly carried into effect. One of its means for preventing that from being done, which ought not to be done, was the granting of injunctions, of enforcing, of doing that which ought to be done, the granting of a decree for specific performance. It will be seen from what has been said that equity is not a system four square in every detail. That, however, has not prevented the satisfactory formulation, or some at any rate, of its basic principles. 12 maxims of equity have done something, if not everything, in the way of this formulation. It stands to reason that they could not do the whole of it, and even in doing what they have done, they have not always managed to keep off one another's ground. Perhaps the spirit which permeates the whole of the 12 maxims is adequately adumbrated in the first one. This is, equity will not suffer a wrong to be without a remedy. It means that In no case will the court suffer a wrong to be unrighted if the court can put it right. This is easily understandable when it is remembered by the very reason why the Court of Chancery grew up at all, or that there were quite a number of wrongs which the Court of Common Law did not put right. It did not, however, follow from that that the courts of Chancery either could or did put right every moral as well as legal wrong. In the nature of things, it could deal effectively only with rights which could be judicially enforced, but which could not be enforced by the courts of common law because of some defect. Hence the definition of equity which was given earlier. This first one of the 12 maxims underlay the jurisdiction of the Chancery Court in the matter of uses and trusts. Thus, originally, if X conveyed land to Y to hold to the use of Z, or on trust for Z, it might happen that Y decided not to hold it to the use of Z at all, but to hold it for his own benefit. And if he did, perpetrated a wrong which was quite capable of being redressed by a court. Further, the same maxim underlies the Chancery Court's auxiliary jurisdiction, of which an example is to order discovery on oath to enable litigants the more effectively to enforce their legal rights. And yet again, the maxim is illustrated by the appointment of a receiver by way of execution. This was done where a plaintiff who had only equitable interest in the property of the judgment debtor, against whom he had succeeded, could not obtain legal execution against that property. It has been stated that the rules of law on equity were alleged to be better in themselves than the rules of common law, and that equity as such claimed on the ground of this very superiority to supersede the common law rule altogether. In practice, however, the Court of Chancery did not ever claim to override the common law courts, as it has well been put at page 34 of the third English edition of Story on Equity. Where a rule either of the common or the statute law is direct and governs the case with all its circumstances, a court of equity is as much bound by it as a court of law and can as little justify a departure from it. This is an admirable exposition of that simply expressed second of the 12 maxims. Equity follows the law, and it makes it clear that equity will depart from common law or from a rule of common law only when that rule takes no account of some important circumstance that may arise. For example, under the common law, the eldest son of an intestate man who died leaving sons, daughters, and an estate in the fee simple was entitled to the whole of the fee simple, and although this worked harshness on the daughters and the remaining sons, equity could not help them. But it would help them if the intestacy had been brought about by the lucky eldest son promising his father to divide the fee simple with the other sons and with the daughters, thus prevailing upon him to refrain from making a will, and then the eldest son did not carry out his promise. The third maxim is, where there is equal equity, the law shall prevail, although it is often put in Latin. An illustration of the first of the two maxims may be cited in the example that where a person has purchased for value the legal estate, he takes it free from all prior equitable estates unless they have been registered as land charges. In illustration of the second, the example that if two people, one after the other, have acquired equitable interest in the same property, the earlier acquired interest will stand even if the person acquiring the later interest had, when he acquired it, no notice that the first interest was already in existence. The fifth maxim is he who seeks equity must do equity, and the most frequent illustration of it is what is called the wife's equity to a settlement. This phrase was used to describe the principle applied by the Court of Chancery when husbands went to it for help in getting possession of property to which they were entitled in right of their wives. They did not get that help unless they accepted the condition that they should execute a fair settlement of some part of the property on their wives and children. Again, the court refused to order delivery up to a borrower from an unregistered moneylender of securities which he had mortgaged, except on the borrower's agreeing to repay the loan. The sixth maxim, he who comes into equity must come with clean hands, is imbued with the same spirit as is the fifth. It differs from it, however, in its disciplinary scope and activities, for it looks censoriously to what the seeker after equity has done in the past rather than admonitorily to what he is going to do in the future, where, for example, an infant falsely held herself out as being over 21 and thus obtained from her trustees a transfer of stock to which she was not entitled until she was 21, and when she was actually 21 tried to force them to pay the stock to her again, the court would not allow this. True, the receipt of an infant could not then discharge a debt, though Section 21 of the Law of Property Act 1925 has modified that position to the extent of providing that a married infant can give valid receipts for income. The word income to include, in that connection, statutory accumulations of income during minority. But the infant could not be allowed to say, I know that I said I was 21 when I was not, but although that was a falsehood, I am going to ask to be allowed to rely on the fact that I gave the receipt when I was not 21, and that it is therefore invalid. The seventh maxim is delay defeats equities, or equity aids the vigilant and not the indolent, or again, they may use the Latin phrase. Laches is the word used to describe the delay which is long enough to deprive the delaying persons of the equitable remedies that might otherwise have been open to them. The eighth maxim is equality is equity, and perhaps the best illustration of it is illustrated by equity's dislike of joint tenancies and construing them whenever it could as tenancies in common. A tenancy was a joint tenancy if its nature was such that on the death of one of the joint tenants his personal representatives got nothing at all, but the whole of his interest went to the surviving joint tenant. Equity, therefore, will in many cases treat joint tenants as tenancies in common. But the survivor of a joint tenancy, thus having, although entitled in law to the whole of the property, to treat some portion of it as if he was holding it as trustee for the personal representatives of the joint tenant who has died. It would do this, for example, in the case of joint purchases and joint mortgages, where one of those who have advanced the purchase money or the mortgage money has died. The ninth maxim is equity looks to the intent rather than to the form. This maxim practically explains itself, and it is enough to say that it is the basis of the equitable doctrines by which forfeitures, mortgages and penalties are regulated. The tenth maxim is equity looks on that as done which ought to have been done. This maxim is made use of most often in the spirit of contract. In many cases, that is to say, equity would treat a contract to do a thing as if it had already been done, but will do so only in favour of persons who are entitled specifically to enforce the contract. For example, if a specifically enforceable agreement for a lease has been entered into, any court which has jurisdiction to enforce the agreement with regard to a person who under the agreement has entered into possession of the land, as if he was, as between the other party and himself, in the position that he would have been had the lease been granted. Also dependent on the same maxim is the equitable doctrine of conversion, which the master of the rolls, Sir Thomas Sewell, stated, nothing is better established than this principle, that money directed to be employed in the purchase of land and land directed to be sold and turned into money are to be considered as that species of property into which they are directed to be converted, and this in whatever manner the direction is given, whether by will, by way of contract, marriage articles, settlement or otherwise, and whether the money is actually deposited or only covenanted to be paid, whether the land is actually conveyed or only agreed to be conveyed, the owner of the fund or the contracting parties may make land money and money land. It will be seen that for all practical purposes, conversion turns personality into reality and reality into personality. And the essential nature of the tenth maxim of equity to the doctrine, it might also be said it is inherent in it, is readily clear. Of the 11th maxim, equity imputes an intention to fulfil an obligation, are founded the doctrines of performance and satisfaction. The doctrines of performance is expressed in the opening paragraph of chapter 14 of the 22nd edition of Snell as follows. Where the person covenants to do an act, if he does some other act of a kind to be available for the performance of his covenant, he is presumed to have had the intention of performing the covenant because equity imputes an intention to fulfil an obligation. And in the opening paragraph of the next chapter of the same work it is stated, satisfaction closely resembles performance. Both depend upon presumed intention to carry out an obligation, but in satisfaction the thing done is something different from the thing agreed to be done, whereas in performance the identical set which the party contracted to do is considered to have been done. The 12th and last maxim is equity acts in personam. The maxim describes the procedure of equity, may indeed be called the governing principle of that procedure. Originally, the Court of Chancery made orders not against the property of a defendant but against the defendant himself, and if he disobeyed the order, punished him personally. But though imprisonment might bring about a moral satisfaction, it did not invariably get done that which it was desired to get done. to which end, therefore, the Court of Chancery came to issue writs of sequestration. The sequestrators thereunder appointed started by taking possession of the property in dispute. If that course was not efficacious, they took possession of some of the defendant's property, then of more and more of it, and if necessary, of the whole of it, until the defendant did what the court had ordered him to do. Since 1925, the court has had the further power in this behalf of making vesting orders of or of appointing persons to execute transfers. That, broadly speaking, empowers the court where persons will not obey an order of the court to execute a document or endorse a negotiable instrument to nominate others to do the act for them. It was stated that for some 250 years and more after the victory of Lord Ellesmere over Lord Justice Coke, the common law and equity went very much their separate ways, and did so, as has been pointed out, in their separate courts. The Judicature Act 1873, however, fused the administration of law and equity. By that act, all the superior courts were amalgamated into the Supreme Court of Judicature, which, in its turn, was divided into the High Court and the Court of Appeal. The High Court and the Court of Appeal were thenceforth entrusted with the administration of both law and equity, and the High Court absorbed the courts of Queen's Bench, Exchequer and Common Pleas, and the Court of Chancery. Considerations of convenience, too, made expedient the separation of the High Court into the divisions familiar today. To the Chancery Division are assigned most of the equitable matters which the old Court of Chancery dealt. To the King's Bench Division most of those which were the province of the Common Law Courts, but, and it is a big but, by Section 4, Subsection 4 of the Judicature Act 1925, which subsection was itself added by Section 6 of the Administration of Justice Act 1920, all the divisions of the High Court have all the jurisdictions of the High Court. All the judges of the divisions must recognise all equitable rights, obligations and defences and must give effect to them. All legal rights and obligations must also be recognised and given effect to, and all remedies to which parties may be entitled in respect of any legal or equitable claim must be granted. The object of these provisions is to secure as far as possible the complete and final determination of all matters in controversy between the parties, and to avoid all multiplicity of legal proceedings. See Judicature Act 1925, sections 36 to 44. Every division of the court, thus High Court, thus being now a court of equity as well as of law, see Snell, 22nd edition, page 10, there are nevertheless specially assigned to the Chancery Division the matters which the Court of Chancery originally dealt with. See Judicature Act 1925, section 56, which replaces section 34 of the law of 1873. Those matters are, 1, the administration of the estates of deceased persons, 2, the dissolution of partnerships or the taking of partnership or other accounts, 3, the redemption or foreclosure of mortgages, 4, the raising of charges on land, 5, the sale and distribution of the proceeds of sale of property subject to any lien or charge, 6, the execution of charitable trusts or private trusts, 7, rectification, setting aside or cancellation of deeds or other written instruments, 8, specific performance of contracts between vendors and purchasers of real estates, including contracts for leases, and 10, wardship of infants and the care of their estates. Also, except whatever all other express provisions and subject to enactments relating to the procedure of the Supreme Court, there are assigned to the Chancery Division all matters under the property statutes of 1925.